CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 20, with Damien Gatinel from France. Now, I first met Damien many years ago, probably 20 years ago, and I've seen him and interact with him on the podium at many different meetings from around the world. And I always learn something from him. He's incredibly bright. Of course, he's an MD, a physician, a surgeon, of course. But he also has two PhDs. He has a background in physics and optics, mathematics. He's incredibly bright. Some of the new trifocal IOL designs came from him and his understanding of this. So he has some great information to share with us. He boils down these very complicated subjects, and I don't have a PhD in physics or optics, so he boils it down to a very understandable way. So it's clinically relevant for us, surgically appropriate. I think you'll really enjoy it, and you'll learn something that's going to help you in your clinic today. Check it out.
I want to welcome you to our Cataract Coach podcast, and today we have Dr. Damien Gatinel. Damien is a true physician scientist. He, of course, is a refractive surgeon, both corneal and lenticular, but in addition, he has a huge expertise in mathematics, optics, physics, and he brings all that together to help give us the next generation of technologies that are going to help our patients in refractive surgery. You've probably already used his designs. He's designed trifocal lenses. He's been involved with a lot of corneal refractive surgery. So, Damien, welcome. Thank you for being on our podcast.
Thanks, Uday, for this invitation. I'm very pleased to be here tonight with you. I mean, tonight my time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, obviously, you work very hard. It's about 10 o'clock at night for you, but you still have time to do this podcast, and we're very thankful. Now, I've learned from you over the course of 20 years, and I've seen you at meetings across the planet. What was your path to ophthalmology? Because it's very unusual that you have both two PhDs as well as an MD, and you really combine the science and the medicine together.
Yes, I think this is exactly as you said. I wanted to combine some science and being a doctor at the same time. And when I was a younger student, I was attracted by physics, optics. And at the same time, I had, as we say, a vocation to become a doctor, an MD. And I believe that ophthalmology appeared to me as the intersection of a medical specialty and also some hard science, because it's not really difficult to guess that if you do ophthalmology, you will have to deal with optics, some modeling. At least I had this precognition that I would really be involved in some things like that. In fact, to be honest with you, I thought that ophthalmology was mainly to correct for refractives, for refractive errors. I didn't really know about everything else, and this I discovered through my studies, but I kept myself closer to the optics and the visual reparation, I mean the visual recovery, but on the optical part, not on the retinal side, I would say.
Right. So, yeah, your background with mathematics and the physics and the optics obviously goes very well with cataract refractive surgery, not so much with, let's say, retina surgery, strabismus surgery, or oculoplastics.
Exactly. Exactly. So I was confronted with these subspecialties, which were quite interesting, but I always got back to refractive surgery. And interestingly, my fellowship, the first one I did in France, was in the retinal department, but I was lucky enough that I was the only one that seemed to be interested in anterior segment. And my boss at that time said, well, you know, Damien, I feel you have an inclination for this. And guess what? We need someone to deal with anterior segment. So please develop this. And I was very happy to have this opportunity.
Oh, fantastic. So you did your training in the sciences in physics, mathematics, optics first before going to medical school?
Well, I did a little bit first, and then in parallel, then I stopped, because you cannot do everything at the same time. You cannot do, you cannot be on call. You cannot be at 7 a.m. at the hospital and doing these things. But when I got a little more time, I resumed with that. I was also lucky to meet with, at that time, Dimitri Azar, who was at that time associate professor at the MIE hospital, the Harvard University. Sure. And he strongly pushed me and encouraged me to pursue in this direction. And this was the early 2000s. And at that time, you know, there was the introduction of aberrometry, the development of refractive surgery. So I thought I was surfing on the right wave at that time, and I was lucky to have this interaction with him and with some other also French colleagues, and be pushed by a kind of wave which was pushing towards more and more sophistication in refractive surgery. As you know, in the past, refractive surgery had a kind of so-and-so reputation. People were like flap and zap, you know, it was a kind of money-making subspecialty, which was a bit like looked at with a little contempt. And I think over the last decade, it has changed a lot, where now people believe it's quite complicated and you cannot be refractive surgeon on your spare time. You have to go and dive into it if you want to do a good job, because of the optics, because of the all the things that brought with biomechanics, you know, all these things, wound healing, inflammatory control, epithelial modeling, all these things went and were really making a refractive surgery a very rich specialty. And also, of course, the intersection with cataract surgery, which has the strongest refractive dimension since the introduction of astigmatism control, asphericity control, multifocality, all these things are really also important now.
That's a very good point. If you look back 15, even 20 years ago, refractive surgery was just thought of as, let's say, corneal refractive surgery, mostly excimer laser based. But now we understand it's you have to have the full spectrum from keratorefractive surgery, of course, phakic IOLs, but also cataract surgery. Now, cataract surgery is, like you said, our most powerful refractive surgery. You can correct plus 20 hyperopia or minus 40 myopia. You can correct them both.
Yeah. And what happens now is that we have more and more patients that had LASIK in the past. So you had LASIK, the patient had LASIK, then he must have cataract surgery. And sometimes you have a refractive surprise, and then you use the previous LASIK to do a touch-up. So it's really like interesting that those stories get now very entangled. And if you probably just do cataract refractive surgery, but have no personal experience with corneal refractive surgery, it may be more difficult to manage those cases than if you do both and can have a fit into two domains.
Yes,
so
for sure.
I think it's becoming more and more important. And I've noticed as well that the increasing number of patients who come now with a history of refractive surgery, corneal-based refractive surgery, is driving cataract surgeons to understand corneal optics. And this is also, again, making those two worlds more and more closer together. Whereas, again, 20 years ago, it was really different.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. Even on the IOL side, you know, when we first, if you look back 15 years ago, 20 years ago almost, and you had the new generation at that time of diffractive IOLs, they weren't truly multifocal, they were bifocal. And we've since moved to trifocal designs like yours. Tell me why trifocal is so much better than the older bifocal designs.
Well, interestingly, you know, I was pushing, I mean, I co-developed the first trifocal IOL, which was introduced in Europe now in 2010, so 13 years ago, because I was using bifocal, like the Restore lens, and my patients were telling me that they were happy with the reading. And at that time, there was no tablets yet. You know, it was more reading a book. People had domestic computers, but they were not so much on the internet as they are today. So what they told was that they what they told me was that they had a problem with screen distance, that they had to go very away from it or very close to it, and this was driving attraction to intermediate vision more and more. And my first idea at that time was, why don't we do a distance intermediate instead of a distance near for those patients who manifest a strong desire for spectacular independence for the intermediate vision. It grew up like that. And so the story is long, but I also had some interest in understanding diffractive optics. And I knew how maybe to design something that would be intermediate vision and near vision, but it was a bit fuzzy. And then the story was that there was a company in Belgium who was interested to develop a new IOL, which became the first trifocal, because it provided intermediate foci between the distance and the near one. And to accomplish this was not so difficult. Of course, it was when we started from scratch. But when you look at it today, I think it was not so difficult to design it because it's a natural thing that you deal with kind of harmonics. What I'm saying is that if you have a plus two lens, it could be also a plus four because there are always more than one foci, you know, but it has not so much energy. And doing the opposite kind of thinking lets you understand that if you have a three addition, you can also find somewhere a 1.5 addition within the same lens, provided that you do some little adjustment of the steps height and etc. So that's how it was on the market. The development. Then at that time there was not so much regulation, so CE marking was easier than it would be today. So I doubt that today we would do the same success story because of regulation. But at that time it was easier, so that's again, timing was good. And there was, you know, if you have something which is successful, usually it requires two things, that there is a demand on the market and the idea is robust enough so you can push and develop it. And this was a kind of miracle that everything was aligned so this lens could appear. And I'm happy now to realize that for presbyopia correcting IOLs, the trifocal is now the reference, and nobody really mentioned bifocals distance near anymore, or it's quite not so often that they are really excited by those lenses. Now it's a trifocal lens for which is first considered, or EDOF lenses, but no more bifocals. And interestingly, the iPad was launched in March 2010, same month that the fine vision lens from Fiziol was launched in Europe by a strange coincidence.
Perfect timing. So how do you make the judgment call now between an EDOF or extended depth of focus lens versus trifocal? So in my own practice, while I tried to embrace the EDOF lenses early on, I found that it just, without doing significant monovision, was not sufficient to give patient satisfaction.
Well, I think it's quite difficult to draw a line. I mean, it's easy to draw a line between strict trifocal and an EDOF lens in terms of optics design, because a trifocal lens must really induce trifoci for a certain pupil diameter. But what's interesting is that if you take most of the trifocal on the market and analyze them on an optical bench on a small pupil diameter, sure, like 2 millimeter, then you realize that the small pupil diameter provides a kind of EDOF effect on the trifocal lens. And so you have a kind of a plateau curve from distance almost to near. Whereas on the larger diameter, you can see on the MTF, you know, the modulation transfer curve, sure, like the optical in vitro contrast sensitivity curve, you can see that you see three foci which are obvious. And therefore, an EDOF lens is a lens which does not really provide those three foci, but rather, under certain condition, extend the depth of focus from the distance foci or the distance vision, far vision, to the intermediate range. And you know, the EDOF, I would say, motivation was that with trifocal lenses, bifocal lenses, there were high low glare described by some patients for good reasons, because if you have more than one foci, you must expect some defocus light, right? But the idea was that it would be a very good compromise for patient to have the benefit of a kind of extended depth of focus without the hassle of it, which is the halos and glare. But it turns out in my practice that it's difficult to first be very predictive with EDOF lenses, because some condition may preclude the real EDOF effect depending on corneal asphericity, pupil diameter. And it's a bit obscure how the lens works sometimes. I have a fellow in my department, Benjamin Stern, who's from Israel. He's doing a nice research on analyzing IOLs on an optical bench that we acquired. We can analyze diffractive, refractive lenses. And doing this, what we learned, because you can also simulate various corneal shapes, that a need of lens on a bench can behave like a good monofocal lens if the corneal aberration of the eye compensates exactly for the spherical aberration, which is intended to provide the extended depth of focus. So these lenses, they are based on some assumptions which are not always matched by the patient's anatomy, whereas diffractive lenses have a kind of structure which is a replicate of foci, which is more or less robust to the cornea. At least it's like a copy paste of the cornea. Sure. It's not like an extension of the conoid of the light rays, which requires again some modeling assumption. And I've seen like wrong reasoning that we and Benjamin now understand, like, oh, I have a patient, he had LASIK. Oh, I'm not sure of the accuracy of my IOL calculation in this context. So let's use a EDOF lens. And it turns out the patient has LASIK in the past. He has a lot of positive spherical aberration.
Sure.
This positive spherical aberration, in fact, could be per se a nice EDOF inducer, but the surgeon wants to use an EDOF lens to compensate for the uncertainty. Then he uses a negative spherical aberrated lens like the IANS, for example. And then what happens, at least on our simulations, is that those two lenses, the cornea, which is very positively aberrated, and the lens, provide the eye with a very strong monofocal kind of refractive properties, which, if you're lucky, will be right on retina, but maybe off the retina. Then you finally get to the point that you did worse than if you had maybe used a neutral lens or a slightly positive aberrated lens. So I think the future will see more and more customization or attempt to customize and to better apprehend those interactions, which are tricky. And for this, I believe that manufacturers should give more insights about their lenses, the mechanism that they employ to provide the depths of focus. If they don't, we will try to do it for them.
those are all great points. I mean, so you've got to take into the patient's anatomy, like your example with positive spherical aberration of the cornea, a lot of it from old LASIK, that itself gives a wider depth of focus for the patient. So of the big class of these, for EDOF lenses, let's say you have a diffractive version like the Technis Symphony, you have a beam-shaping element like the Alcon Vivity, you've got a small aperture like the Acufocus IC8, and maybe you even have monofocal plus, which is not quite EDOF, but let's say like a Technis IHANS. How do you choose this for each patient? Are you have a lot of options.
Exactly. So, well, it's a good question. Again, I would choose based on some assumptions and a kind of a little instinct that if the patient has, for example, a very negatively aberrated cornea, like he had hyperopic LASIK in the past, I would probably not use the IANS, which is bringing another layer, right? So what we realize is that you mentioned the Vivity lens. The Vivity lens, as you say, has a kind of motif, which is a little plateau that you can see at the slit lamp, you know, very close to the center. And interestingly, this lens, I would choose it, for example, for a patient who has an eye which dilates quite significantly in mesopic condition. Why that? Because this lens is, in fact, like a lens where the addition is in the center of the lens. So when the pupil dilates, in fact, there is more energy to the distance foci, whereas when the pupil is small, the energy is splitted a bit. Not like a diffractive lens, this is a debate we could have, but let's say with, as they call it, a stretch of the wavefront, which is a bit kind of maybe marketing term, because every lens stretches the wavefront anyway. unless it's a planar lens. But what happens is this lens is like, again, the larger the pupil, the less you can see the impact of the central ring. Yes. Whereas on the other hand, if you have a patient who's for which you expect a EDOF on the larger pupil, you would use maybe an aspheric lens to get maybe an effect again, which would be maybe more interesting for a less dilating pupil, let's say, or more like a constant pupil aperture. So you have a kind of a constant performance of the lens, something like that. But again, what we do now with Benjamin is try to analyze the impact of pupil diameter and corneal asphericity. And with those two metrics, we simulate the behavior of all these lenses, and we find that there are couples, like combinations, I would say, of pupil diameter and asphericity, which for a specific lens makes the lens quite good monofocally speaking, like for distance vision, or good for a EDOF effect. So now you see it becomes quite more interesting and more difficult. Yeah. In the future, you would ask the patient, well, what would you do? What do you want? The patient would say, I want this more than that. So you would translate this in your mind. So the patient is more like willing good distance and maybe a little near, but all the other situation, etc. And from this kind of constraints, you would find candidate lenses that would provide the expected performance, provided that this eye has this pupil dynamics and this asphericity, provided that the pre-op pupil dynamics echo the post-op, which is not, of course, as simple as I say it. But that's probably what would make this field a bit more, let's say, precise and refined than now, where we navigate with the wet fingers, you know, like you get the wind direction.
But it becomes a very complicated decision tree, because now we're taking into account patient's refractive state, pupil size. You may want to take an angle and alpha angle cap even. Mm-hmm. You're looking at the corneal asphericity. Now you want to pair this with the patient's desires and one of many different option lenses. So I agree with you. It's very difficult to figure out what's the best solution.
It is. And it's interesting that I was at ACOS the other weekend, 2 weeks ago now, and there was, when we showed some results on some lenses, some doctors came, like, for example, there was a lens that when the pupil is small, the power is more than when the pupil is large. It was an aspheric lens. Because, you know, they use those complicated spherical aberration, which can be negative here, positive there. So eventually what happens is when you just look at the MTF, you see two peaks, but one peak can disappear when the pupil constricts, and this peak would not be the distance, would be the distance one. So the lens is like, it's a 22 lens for a small pupil, but then it becomes a bifocal 22 and a bit less power. So suddenly the distance power appear for a larger pupil. Well, that can be interesting, but what is then the lens power? And there are doctors who told me, oh, with this lens, I had some myopic surprises.
Yes, for sure. Yes.
And I told them, well, maybe check the pupil diameter with this lens. If the patient had a small pupil, you would be in the position that in the situation where the lens has more power than when the pupil dilates. So, and again, even when you vary the positive spherical aberration of the lens, the peak, which is at the height of the peak, would at least theoretically, you know, when you do a through focus, you have a peak, and you can assume that the highest part of the peak corresponds to the, when there is only one peak, I say, to the power of the lens, right? And sometimes this peak shifts back and forth on a range of about one diopter, just by changing the corneal spherical aberration and the pupil diameter.
Wow.
So that may explain also those little refractive surprises sometimes, or these tendencies that these lens behave like this or like that. But it's very complicated, because of course you would adjust the constant, or the manufacturers would do this for you, but then you may lose one part of the EDOF expected effect. So it's fascinating. At the same time, it's sometimes a bit disconcerting, but that's interesting at least.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've all experienced that. Our patients with these EDOF lenses, and we didn't take into account pupil size, and you see post-op the myopic surprise. And so now it becomes be more complicated. So even our lens calculations, perhaps we need to include more data. Lens calculations should be more than just axial length, keratometry, and AC depth. We should, for the lens, we should also take into account maybe corneal sphericity as well as pupil size.
Yeah, and you mentioned ACD. I'm sure, and it's of course demonstrated since a long time that ACD also controls for depth of focus. So this is another dimension that if you vary it, you may have also significant impact on the achieved depth of focus. That's quite another problem. Problem or opportunity, but this is something we don't control much. So pupil diameter, actual length, pupil diameter, corneal sphericity, and ACD may govern a lot of the EDOF, depth of focus effect. And that's why, you know, and I'm sure you have observed this before I did, like you have patients with monofocal lenses, they do well, like 20/20, Jagger 3,
yes,
uncorrected, and you're like, wow. And these patients should be focused because they may give the clue of why is this effect of surprisingly good depths of focus occurring. And they probably have small pupils, that's I'm
right.
sure.
Yes, and for sure.
You have a pinhole effect. So when you mention this pinhole lens, I think this is the easiest yes. way to get good depths of focus, maybe at the expense of retinal illumination a bit, maybe. But if you have aberration, you don't think you can control them. I think this works quite well. I've been implanting the camera inlay in the cornea a long time ago, and this was very effective for the near. And surprisingly, I would say even well tolerated in the cornea. So I'm both biologically in most patients, as opposed to the reputation, I still see patients with now 13 years wow. of camera inlay implantation, and they have inflammation, but they tolerate it well. So if it's in the IOL plane, this little pinhole effect, it's even better, I think, optically speaking, and it should very be efficient, especially if you have aberration or things that may be uncontrollable, like keratoconus cases. I would recommend that lens, or just in normal corneas to have a pinhole effect, which is probably the most robust way to get like in photography, extended depths of field in photography, so in focus in the case of the eye. Yeah.
Yeah, just have a smaller aperture. But then, as you said, it comes at the expense of decreased retinal illumination, particularly at night.
Exactly. So I think it's recommended to just use the lens in the non-dominant eye, right?
Correct. That's the current recommendations. Now, it seems to me trifocal lenses are a lot more forgiving in terms of pupil size and corneal issues. Do you find that as well?
Yes. Again, especially the diffractive lenses are kind of immune to this, partly at least because diffraction is creating a replication of the combination of the corneal and the lens power, but at different vertices. So I like the copy-paste image because it gives you an idea that it will work in some ways, regardless of the pupil aperture, more or less. Again, the diffraction is like ventilating light to different foci, and that will happen regardless of the pupil aperture, because the first rings usually happens in the 1 millimeter, 1.5 millimeter, and usually the pupil is a bit larger than that. I think, and if the pupil is smaller, it will be like a EDOF lens, so it will work still. That's why I think they are robust, but of course, on the other hand, they provide more risk of halo and glare, and this is something you have to look at. But like, usually people are fighting to say this lens is better than that lens, or this concept is better than that concept. To me, what is the best predictor of a patient's successful implantation with a trifocal, for example, is the level of cataract pre-op. Because again, and of course, the patient motivation and his visual history. That is, let's take the most difficult case of the -2, -45 clear lens patient wanting spectacular independence at all distances. The patient has very good distance corrected vision with his spectacle or contact lens. He has very good near vision. So the brain is tuned. So the image must be sharp at distance and sharp at near. Of course, with correction, but that's not how patients believe.
Yeah, they don't think that way.
Yeah, yeah, they think they want this vision at distance and this at near. It's like you go to the restaurant, you're used to this taste and that taste. They don't want a compromise. And if you try to use a trifocal lens for the same retinal image that would make a cataractous patient with a hyperopic history very happy, sure, for the same vision, the -2, -45 clear lens will be very dissatisfied, because everything that will impair the vision that he didn't have before will be for him a deception. And also, what is very important to realize is that the -2 or -3 or myopia provides the best near ever that you cannot match with any multifocal IOL, which is always a compromise and etc. So if you have a myopic habitus for the near, it's very difficult to be satisfied, in my experience, with a diffractive lens, sorry. Of course, patients can cope with when you explain them thoroughly and they accept that they will need light. It won't be like myopia, but they will be able to decipher, as they say, a little card, a smartphone, etc. So that's the most difficult case. On the other hand, a cataractous patient who had, at 40, he had spectacles to see at near, and especially if he was hyperopic, uncorrected, so the distance was not very sharp and the near was nothing, and plus he has a cataract, the photon going on the way to the retina are scattered, are lost, sure, absorbed. So the net amount of distance foci light will be higher, even if it's a trifocal, than before, because on 100 photon, like 80 were not going on the retina or focused in front or after. So this is a story which will be having a happy ending at the end, because the patient will see a net improvement, sure, in the vision. So regardless of the IOL you put, of course, IOLs may be better designed in some cases, blah, 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 but he will be happy if he has this near vision distance that he never had before, or sure, never since 20 years, 40 years ago. So that's, to me, the best indication. And then the exact type of lens, of course, I would recommend to use a fine vision lens, which is the way undergoing FDA trial. So my American colleagues will, hopefully, I cannot mention the results, anything, but it's just undergoing FDA trial at now. And I think results have been analyzed now almost for a year, and I hope that will be positive enough so the lens can get FDA approved.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. We'd love to have more IOL options here in the USA. And so we certainly welcome any of these new designs. But I think you've made a very, very important point, which is the patients before versus after. That has to be a net improvement. So if you have that 45-year-old who's a -2 myope and has no cataract, refractive lens exchange, they're just not going to be as happy. But if you start off with a relatively dense cataract or opaque cataract, and the patient's a hyperope to begin with, the patient will be thrilled because the net is an improvement in the quality of vision.
Exactly. I think human beings are sensitive to the net change, not to any absolute status or threshold or whatever. And that's very well explained by when you discuss with patients with like mild cataracts or medium advanced cataract. Well, you say you must see the world in yellow colors. They say no. And then after the lens removal, they say, oh, you were right. But the brain tunes everything up and they have this kind of vision, which they find, well, if you improve it, they'll be happy. If you impair it or reduce some dimensions of their vision, they won't be as happy. And for the same vision, again, a myope will be dissatisfied, a hyperope will praising your merit. And that's really something you learn with experience. And I think the young who listen to this must learn that, again, every patient is different. And what is important is the trajectory you put the patient in, which must go up instead of trying to reach 20/20 or this Jagger 2, or judge your patient through his speech, through his history, through your like common sense. And usually you will do the good choice and have you will avoid some issues with patient who will never be satisfied, even if the surgery is perfect and well executed. Yeah.
Do you think we'll ever get to accommodating IOLs, truly accommodating IOLs? There are a lot of them in trials. There are none quite available just yet. Do you think we'll get there 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now?
I would say first that it's something that fascinates me now that I'm an ophthalmologist, and that the nature has selected a system which is something we could never replicate. You know, we can do artificial tissues, we have developed a substitution for many organs in the body, right? But this stupid, sorry for the word, lens, which is soft and transparent and avascular, and just a strange mechanism that you need a muscle to loosen zonular fibers so that the lens gets back to its natural shape, which is the near vision, and that when you look at distance, the eye rests, but then the zonula stretches and the lens gets to its distance vision in a stretched state. All these things are quite strange. And yet still we never could until now replicate this, because if you do phacoersatz, you know, like Jean-Marie Parel tried to do for years, decades in Bascom-Palmer, you know, they had, everything was almost solved. They could have, you've seen those fascinating, 20 sure. years ago, they could do a mini small rexit, aspirate the crystalline lens cortex, nucleus, fill everything with a gel, almost get a way to make the eye emmetropic, but then PCO would arrive and ruin the surgery. And so it's a long introduction to tell you that, again, this is a fascinating mechanism, which is complex, but could not be replicated. On the other hand, as you know, it lasts for 40 years, and probably life expectancy was this kind of range for like not so long ago in the human history. And maybe two centuries ago, that was a reasonable life expectation. So you would die before you get strong presbyopia, unfortunately. Now we live twice as long as this. And I think maybe we will jump over this accommodative IOL to prevention of lens aging.
Oh. And
if I would do a prevision, and prevision are very difficult, especially when they concern the future, as someone said, funnily. But if you want to make a prediction, it could be that we would first prevent the lens to age
sure.
from aging, then so keep the softness and the transparency of it using nanotechnologies or genetics, telomerase, you know, all this anti-aging kind of dynamics. And because if you want to do an accommodative lens, there are many issues that I don't think can be solved very easily, like even the power of the system. So you can think of solar battery or using the electricity provided by muscles, but the biotolerance would be difficult because the space is very minimal, right? And then you have the optical integration, PCO to control for.
So it may just be easier prevent it in the first place. Give some sort of treatment when you turn about 40 years old to prevent lens hardening and opacification.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that one day technology will be strong enough to replicate what accommodation is. It's just because when Jules Verne wrote, this story to the moon, people would probably say you're crazy. We don't even have something that fly in the air, right? Yeah. But it took less than a century to make this, or about a century to make this happen. So one day that will, I think everything that the human beings imagine happens at some point. It takes a long route, and some genius people have even forecasted, like, you know, Einstein, he predicted the laser that we use now from his complete equations, and it took half a century to make the first prototype of a laser, but he predicted that if one day we could master the way that light can be controlled, you could have a very high energy lens, which would be very directional, blah, blah, blah. He did not employ the word laser, of course, he didn't say, because this was an acronym developed much later, but he described the laser effect. So everything that the human kind foresee happens at some point. That can be scary on other aspects, by the way. So this will happen, but will we see it, you and me, or will our young colleagues see it? Maybe, but I'm not sure of that. Maybe they will see more a prevention of cataract or biomolecular repair of the aging lens. And that would be probably making pharmaceutical companies happy, that if you have a drop, which you put every day once you reach 30, like a kind of Botox for the lens.
Yes.
They would be...
They'd be very happy.
Oh, my God, yes. So,
yeah, but even if you look at what we've seen in the last 20, 25 years in ophthalmology, how much we've changed. You don't do surgery like you did from 20 years ago. Incisions are smaller. We're far more efficient. We're far safer surgery. IOL options are certainly a lot more now. I think it'll keep progressing. And like you said, we went from the Wright brothers, the first airplane, to landing on the moon in something like 60 or 70 years, less than
not even that. Atlantic was crossed in 1928, 1969, something like that. And 40 years later, the Apollo mission landed on the moon. So, yeah, it's to me, that's, this example shows the fastest progress in any domain in technology. And probably today we have another very large acceleration in artificial intelligence, computer power, which is maybe the equivalent of this astronautical era one century ago, by the way. This is maybe now the century of this kind of booming, but it goes very fast, and in short career time, as you said, we see things like completely revolutionized, at least for corneal refractive surgery. When I discuss with my patient, I say, what you will undergo is a bit science fiction. If I would explain you in detail that the laser can fire 200,000 spots per second, spots which brevity is such as if a spot would be, I don't want to say stupid things, but last 10 minutes, it would be 20 years between each spot. This is a ratio between the length of a femto laser, you know, and the time between.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
200,000 seems very short, but if you match this with a femto, it's like very long. So it's probably like 10 minutes, 25 years. 20 minutes,
yeah. 25 years. The ratio.
Yeah, the ratio between the spot. I mean, the light makes 7 times around the Earth in 1 second, or goes to the moon. By the duration of one laser spot, femto spot emission, it just travels like 100 microns or 400 microns.
Yeah, like almost nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. So it's crazy, this brevity. And this brevity gives a very high power for very low intensity and provides the miracle of cutting transparent tissue very efficiently and precisely. And all this, you know, it's always funny that it requires like a one-ton machine to model and deliver accurately a very, very small spot. But you need like a ton of instruments just at the end
for such a tiny little thing. Yeah.
Yes. And this is also another threshold which shows the technological achievements that we did in a very short period of time compared to the human history.
Where do you think we're going? What's coming next in keratorefractive surgery? What's coming next in corneal treatments?
Corneal treatments, maybe artificial corneas, I would say, could be.
What about on the refractive side? I mean, right now we're doing, you know, SMILE or LASIK or PRK. Are we going to do that? Are we going to have presbyopic ablation profiles be more widely accepted for that? Are we going to have newer devices? What do you think is coming?
I think the progress in those domains you cited are a bit asymptotic now. LASIK can still progress, but we are really reaching what we can do with current technology. We have aberrometry guided instrument. We are maybe what we should maybe now focus on is the way to anticipate or even control wound healing, especially. I think the domain where I'm surprised that there are companies, I'm not mentioning them, but they are investing a lot of on mild myopia correction, which is already so good that I cannot really remember a patient that over the last 5 years told me, I wish my visual quality was better when there's no complication. I mean, what they tell you, I wish I didn't have dry eye as much as I have.
Sure.
You know, so trying to make this even more precise to me does not make sense, because you play with the background noise, and it's not because you will measure this or control for that you will do a better job, as long as you match the treatment with the pupil diameter when you can have flaps for which you control the quality so that they are well centered and you avoid micro folds, etc. The area, the domain, is before presbyopia, I think, astigmatism and maybe even more hyperopia, which is now limited to +2, +4, but we pushed it now to +6, +7 in some specific cases, because we tried to understand what were the limitation, and the wound healing is the main problem because of the shape of the treatment. There is, like, you know, this groove in the periphery which epithelium
grows in, right.
So that's an area where if you could control that, prevent this or anticipate for it, you would improve hyperopic results, prevent a bit regression, and improve those treatments. So that's an area, and there are many hyperopic patients, and some of them are despaired. And hyperopia is connected to presbyopia a lot. So every benefit, every progress you achieve with hyperopic correction, you can translate it or incorporate it to improve also presbyopic treatments. To improve presbyopic treatments, I think the first thing would be to improve the semantics, because it's a bit like as soon as you touch presbyopia, everyone thinks that they can introduce new concepts out of the blue, like wavefront stretching, presby something, and use concepts which are a bit fuzzy, or I had this expression the other day, which was not maybe the best one, but magic, like... But at the end, it's always trying to put myopia somewhere in the pupil.
Yeah, and, of course.
It kills the romanticism of those techniques. But if you have no myopia somewhere in the pupil, there's no chance that a presbyopia profile will work. And if you notice well, apart from the company with which I work, which is Alcon, for developing what's called the Reed algorithm, which is in Europe now introduced on one of their laser, which is like using a kind of addition which is compensated for the distance with some asphericity correction on the cornea. All other approaches are like using spherical aberration or a kind of a shape change. But at the end, when you look at topographies and aberrometries of all these eyes, they have always the same kind of tendency, that is, most of them have a myopic refraction in the center of the pupil, and a reduction of this myopic error towards the edge of the pupil. And it's sometimes even impossible from the wavefront to distinguish between a eye ends implantation, just the wavefront, total eye wavefront. I mean, you have negative spherical aberration usually, which can be from the lens or from the cornea, but it's difficult to say. But it's usually the same kind of titration, because optics is optics, and once the lens has gone through the cornea and IOL, it has to match certain criteria to provide the reasonable extended depth of focus. And there's no 10,000 ways to achieve that. And to achieve this, you need myopia somewhere. So I like to tell the young doctors that instead of believing that there is a magic kind of a wavefront, this and that, there's more pragmatically an area where the refraction is dominated by a myopic error, surrounded by an area, or the opposite, there is an area of ametropia surrounded by an area where refraction is more myopic.
Sure.
And this is a definition of spherical aberration you can use, that is, but it's not as sexy as using other terms, but spherical aberration is where power changes across the pupil from the center to the periphery. It can decrease, it can increase. What is very important is that if you work with negative spherical aberration, you must, and I say must with a big M majuscule, have myopic refraction centrally. Because negative spherical aberration means that the power of your system reduces toward the periphery. The problem in Europe, and you know presbyopia as a kind of a mitigated, because in the beginning people say, oh, I'm going to introduce some prolate aspherization. And when they did that, what they did not realize is that they made the cornea flatter in the periphery. So they had negative spherical aberration, but a central emmetropization, and then a reduction of the power, which is hyperopia, and it didn't work. So they say, oh, we should add myopic correction. I mean, we should induce myopia. We should add some plus to get the effect we want. What they didn't realize is that if you use negative spherical aberration, you need myopia in the center, and the negative spherical aberration induce the distance vision, not the near. That's very important. Negative spherical aberration induces distance vision because negative spherical aberration is less power in the periphery. So if you have emmetropia in the center again and less power in the periphery, you have useless depth of focus because you have an eye which is emmetrope, and when the pupil dilates, it becomes hyperopic. No use, right? Whereas if you have a pupil which is centrally dominated by myopia, when the pupil dilates, you have a reduction of this. This improves the distance vision instead of being like in blunt monovision to 20-200. You'll get uncorrected 20-50, 20-40, sometimes even 20-50. Is this correct? I'm trying to convert this.
Yeah,
decimals, but you know what I mean. And that's how it works. But again, it's not very sexy to discuss this, and companies try to create different concepts of depths of focus which can align. But at the end, again, it's always a refractive issue.
So bottom line, no matter what you call it, if you have a corneal ablation profile, you have to have some myopia in the center in the pupil.
Right. Or the periphery. Well, what can be worked is that you do a central myopization on the non-dominant eye because and that's where monovision and multifocality are not so opposite as people would think. I would say that multifocality corneal presbyopic ablations are a way to make monovision less blunt, that is less
full. So less anisometropia.
Yeah, it's a small, when I say small, it's in terms of area. It's a controlled zone of myopization surrounded by emmetropization. And that's how it works. And sometimes on the dominant eye, what you can do is correct the patient for emmetropia in the center and increase the power towards the periphery of the pupil. So there is positive spherical aberration, which can also extend the depth of focus in some ways without too much disturbing the distance vision.
So you can also employ some degree of monovision to advance it even more, right?
To me, it's not so different. Monovision means a certain difference of power between the two eyes. When you have those presby LASIK patients that you analyze, when you refract them on the eye, which is better at near, you must correct them with some myopic spectacle power lenses to increase the distance. So if you tell me that the patient had LASIK and a multifocal ablation, but at the end, when you refract the patient, the non-dominant eye requires a minus 125 to get 20/20, it's a kind of monovision, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So, but the difference is that with true monovision that I like in myopes, for the reason we discussed, that is, I hardly believe that monovision, multifocality can be very successful in myopes because their reference vision is very good near and very good distance. So in these eyes, in these brains, I should say, the best is to have one eye coping with what the brain likes, that is sharp distance, and the other eye sharp near. If the brain can mix and get those images together, that's okay. But if you provide multifocality in a myopic patient, it's not going to work as much as in a hyperope, which is always in the kind of a fuzzy compromise where, you know, they have plus two at distance, but they say, no, no, my vision is fine. And they sometimes swing around the description of their vision. It's very interesting that low hyperope, they don't even want to acknowledge that their distance vision is not good. You know what I mean?
We see it every week in the clinic.
Yeah, same. They say, no, my vision is okay. I say, okay, good. Well, it's enough. I'm happy with it. Yeah, but would you describe it as sharp? They're like, well, it's okay. I'm fine. So I say, it's blurred, right? No, it's not blurred. And once one patient told me, you know, it was hyperopic plus two, like the one we discussed. I made him zero, plano. And he was like 20, he was like decimal 810, so 2050 maybe. You have this? 2030. It was 2030, 2025 almost uncorrected, but not 2020. And I made him 2015 post-op. Yeah. And he complained about the distance. He told me, yeah, it's a bit fuzzy. It's what?
He says, he has hyperopia on the brain. His brain likes hyperopia.
No, but he said, well, first, what you show me is not far away because it's 4 or 5 meters. When they speak about distance vision, hyperopes, it's 200 meters. Yes. Yeah. So for a myope, distance starts at 1 meter, but for a hyperope, it starts at 20 meters. You know, everything closer is close in their mind. That's very important. And I tell this to the young people to avoid problems. When you speak about distance, far distance vision for a myope, it's 4 or 5 meters. But for hyperope, they understand this like 100 yards, 100 meters, right?
Yeah.
You agree with that. And when you show them something on the wall, they say, "Moto, that's close. That's close." So probably they lose a little distance vision. And I think, as you said, their brain is used to hyperopia. Secondly, as one guy told me, you know, he said, before surgery, I didn't see. Now I see fuzzy. I see the blur. That is, they don't see, but they have no perception that their vision is blurred. I think what they interpret the world is like, okay, they have hyperopia, so they don't see the details, but they don't see a blur. They see that they don't see. You know what I mean?
It's like for sure.
A picture where you would remove things, but whereas the myopic blur, they hate it, because if you overcorrect them, when you have a plus two, you make him a minus 0.5. He's crazy. Like, I don't see anything.
Yeah.
It's hell. I'm desperate. Because this now turns for their visual system like in a very dense blur, although they still are like 2023 or even 2025 or sometimes even 2020, but they say, it's blurry. And one reason is probably that I think when they look at 200-300 yards away, the light may be dominated by blue or green colors because the sky is blue. And this blue chromatically is more on the retina because of chromatic blur, you know?
Sure.
Then maybe white light or a red light. So I don't know, but they manage to be very happy. And probably physiologically speaking, the best refraction for an elite shooter or someone who wants to see very far away is plus one, not zero. That's what I know now. I think a plus one patient has the best distance vision, at least objectively. They're like, oh, my vision is so good. But you refract them
plus one.
Yeah, almost plus one. Maybe I exaggerated a bit, but at least plus 0.5, I swear, is better than zero.
Yeah.
For everything which is distance vision appreciation. I'm sure of that. I always notice this. This way, when I do LASIK in young patients, I target if I have an hesitation, I'd rather overcorrect them, because I've never seen one complaining to be overcorrected by half a diopter. But I've seen many patients that they complain a lot of a little blur, like a half or even a quarter of diopters.
Yeah.
Sometimes they make them very unhappy.
So going back to your other example of the 45-year-old patient who has clear lenses and is minus two, what would you offer this patient then? LASIK with some monovision?
Yes. Monovision, I test it. I test it with contact lenses. And it's my first choice in myopes, monovision. I'm not saying that multifocality should be avoided, because I have a bias of perception. I would say that most of the unsatisfied patients that come to me for a second opinion were usually myopes who had a multifocal lens and they are not happy with. So I don't see those who are happy, because they don't have any reason to come and see me. And I've done some trifocal implantation in myopes, in low myopes, but after a very long discussion and in selected patients. So again, monovision, I think, for myopes is good, because it matches what their expectation is, at least monocularly. And the only challenge for them is to accept to lose binocularity, which is not easy. But if it works, it will work. And the best is, like, you can test it easily with contact lenses. So there's no way that you will operate on a patient who will complain after it. It's a debate, you know. I have colleagues, respected colleagues, who tell me, I'll never do contact lens trials, because if you do, you will discourage patients. I want to discourage
patients
that will not be happy, because
of course.
I have enough patients to live life, to have a successful practice. So I just want to avoid unsatisfied patients. That's what I want.
And, I think we all do. So to wrap this up, finally, what would you do for your own eyes today?
What would I do?
What would you choose for yourself?
Well, I'm slightly myopic, so I fall in the category of the, and I use this to compensate presbyopia. So I think I would fall in the monovision because I use it already. Well, but if I had cataract surgery, I would be tempted to start with a non-dominant eye, maybe start with a trifocal lens, of which I know the limitations and the benefits. If I like it, I would do the same
dominant
thing. Well, if I don't like it, I would get emmetropia or even slight emmetropia, because what can be also thought of is that myopic patients like myopia. I like myopia. It's nice to cut from the distance when you want to focus on something. Work on the computer is quite good. But what you could think of is getting a little addition for the distance with the trifocal lens on the non-dominant eye, so that when you go and want to pick something there or just do your shopping, you don't have to wear spectacles, because you have enough distance to navigate wherever you want. And you wouldn't just need spectacles to drive, go to the movie, to have binocular distance. So I would probably try a trifocal on the non-dominant eye, which is left to me, and see what happens. And if I like it, okay. If I don't, well, I still have the other eye, which is dominant to me, to leave it
a little bit myopic with a monofocal.
I could even have a trifocal emmetropic and myopic there. I mean, my brain is ready for that. That's what I'm saying. I would, because I understand those things, and I think I would not be dissatisfied, because I anticipate what would bring this kind of scenario. I thought sometimes of lenses which could be for high myopes. Completely, I mean, why not? I'm thinking sometimes like doing a multifocal lens for high myopes that would have a little foci for the distance. So they would be still in their myopic world, but they would be maybe seeing some details in the distance that they don't. Of course, with low contrast, but if that's enough for you to see who's getting in your office or at home, more presumably they would be spectacle free at home, and they would see who's in the room. They could navigate and get this object. I would like to try this. It's a kind of tricky or unusual concept, but you know, high myopes, we usually hardly make them emmetrope postoperatively, right? We just unless they express a strong desire for uncorrected distance and they are happy to lose the near, usually they want to keep some near. But what if we had a lens which would make the eye -3, -2, or -2, -1, but with a little better distance, with an addition, a negative addition, to get them with a little energy for the distance?
That sounds great. A great idea.
Well, yeah, they could. I think they would, and you would just tell them, you will still need spectacles, but a bit lens for distance. If you look at something, you will see it better than if you don't have this. The blur will be a bit less, especially if you have bright, contrasted images. So you can see, for example, maybe you can watch TV and read because it's very highly contrasted on those displays, you know, LCD or OLED sure. display. You can read the CNN displays. Because it's not so small and it's high contrasted. And if I would speak like a visual scientist, I would rephrase this as there will be enough high special frequency content conveyed on your retina, although not the whole of it. So you can see an A from a D, a T from a J, and read more or less what's written on CNN. Although, of course, to watch a movie to get the full benefit of it, you will need spectacles. That's sure. a question I always had in my mind, and maybe one day someone will come with this concept. Why not?
it sounds like a good option for me. So I'm like you, I'm a low myope, mm-hmm. and after age of 50, being a low myope has become such a blessing, right? When presbyopia hits,
exactly. On the lifespan, the best refraction, if you want to get the best compromise, is probably between -1 and -2, something that's, like that, right?
That's me.
Yeah. So you can sport, you can exercise, work out without anything, sure. social conversation, go to the restaurant. And what we do now is mostly in the near sphere of 1, 1.5 meter, computer, people, family, things like that.
Of course. So I guess the bottom line for this whole podcast is you really do have to tailor your treatment, whether it's corneal, lenticular, whatever refractive surgery you do, you must tailor it to that specific patient. Through their anatomy, the pupil size, the corneal asphericity, but also to what they want, what their brain's used to, what their lifetime refractive error is, and what you can achieve with the before and after improvement.
That's right. I think you must tailor your approach. There's no stereotype that you can apply in ophthalmology to any patient. Every patient is new. Of course, you have categories, and with sure. experience, you can put those patients in those categories, but you must have a full spectrum of possibilities and have no preconceived strategies. And that's the charm of refractive and cataract surgery with this refractive dimension, I believe.
For sure. We have so much still left to learn. So I want to thank you for taking the time to do this podcast. I certainly learned a lot. And I'll put a link below for our viewers so they can see your website and learn more from you.
Yes, my website is in French, but French for everything that people would not really look for. But the content, which is probably more of interest for ophthalmic society, like IOL power calculation fundamentals, or like things like some fancy complications like rainbow glare or asphericity and multifocality, I put it in English to the benefit of the broad community. So of course you can come and visit the website, and don't hesitate to send me message or comment. If you have questions, it helps the webpage to get better and better.
All right, thank you, my friend. Merci beaucoup, bonsoir.
Merci, see you soon, bye, thank you.
Thanks for enjoying that podcast with me. I certainly learned a lot about the physics of optics and the engineering and the IOL designs and where we're going in the future. Really some great information, and I'm sure you enjoyed it too. Remember, I want to hear your feedback. Go to cataractcoach.com, click on the link to contact me, and tell me, do you prefer this as the video we have on YouTube or on Cataract Coach, or do you prefer it as an audio only where we have it on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, etc.? Also, let me know, what can we do better? Do you like the format, about an hour every time as an interview with a well-known ophthalmologist? Or do you have some other suggestions for us? And also, let me know who you would like to have on this podcast in the future. We're going to do a new one every week, so we've got 52 chances a year. I'll see you next week.